Weaver.
Hi, this is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM. We are located on the traditional and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. This episode features Dr. Isaac Soon, a professor at UBC in Ancient Mediterranean and Near Eastern Studies. He focuses on the embodiment of historical figures and disability before it had its label.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's RIDEON Bike Shop. See you there!
What a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Are you hungry? I think I'm hungry. I think we should get ourselves something nice for our beach day.
Oh yeah?
Oh my god, I know the perfect place. Cockney King's Fish and Chips is literally just around the corner. We should go there. It is the best fish and chips in Vancouver.
Oh my god, yes, absolutely. Let's go right now.
Cockney King's Fish and Chips, Kitsilano. On Cornwall Avenue, between Cypress and Walnut. It's the best fish and chips in town, but don't take our word for it. Try it yourself. If Kitsilano isn't your neighborhood, check out Cockney King's in Burnaby or New Westminster.
So hi, Dr. Soon.
Hi.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. I found you actually weirdly through a group project, not a group project, a school project, where I needed to find someone who was well-versed in various religious traditions. But that's how I found you. Would you like to tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm assistant professor of early Christianity here at UBC in the Department of Ancient Mediterranean and Near Eastern Studies. Very long titles. I'm a native of Vancouver, so I grew up in Surrey, actually. I study ancient Christian and Jewish religions, and specifically focusing on embodiment, so things like sexuality, gender, disability, and enslavement.
What time period do you study?
I usually study around the second century BCE to maybe late antiquity, which is like 600 or 700 CE, so about 1,000 years.
Okay, so I'm hearing kind of two themes in your studies, one of which is ancient Christianity and Judaism, and the other one is that you study embodiment. Would you like to speak a little bit more on what exactly that entails?
Yeah, for sure. So human history is often thought about in terms of facts and details and events, and often we're dealing with people's ideas or kind of their afterlife in literary records and grocery lists and artwork, and we kind of forget sometimes that they were also embodied people, and that actually impacts not only our understanding of them, but our understanding of their work and how they lived their lives. So in the particular area of history that I'm involved in social history, which is really thinking not just about facts and figures and events, but thinking about cultures and people and as they live in the world. So that's kind of what my focus on embodiment is really about.
Okay, so you study these figures and their historical significance, but also consider their lived experience in that.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Wow, I'm so smart.
You're a good listener.
Great people, it takes a degree. So why, or how did you get into the field of, or how did you start studying embodiment specifically? Because I feel like history is a much more traditional field of study, but embodiment is a really interesting lens that I haven't heard much about.
Yeah, so I mean, in my graduate work, I started getting interested in the physical appearance of some early Christian figures. So, what did they look like? And is there any information that we can know about their bodies? And that kind of eventually led me to think more about lived experience in the past, especially disability. How do we recover disability? What does it look like? Is it the same from culture to culture, or is it different? And so, that kind of focus on just thinking very simply about, well, what did a guy like Paul the Apostle, who's kind of this key figure in early Christianity, what did he look like, led to wider questions of embodiment.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that one example that I really draw upon that's analogous is, so I grew up playing piano. Beethoven, he was deaf.
Sure. Yeah.
And a lot of people talk about that, but not really much about how his disability affected his work. They're just like, wow, vibrations, how cool.
Yeah, it's a and it and it's all it's a, that's exactly it. And it's often Beethoven's an interesting example, right? Because he's such a prolific composer, and I mean, for like the last decade of his life, he was growing increasingly impaired with his hearing, and so this kind of taps into in disabilities we study. It's kind of like I guess like inspiration porn, or this kind of use of people who are overcoming their disabilities to see how amazing that they've
Yeah.
Kind of come out on the other side. I mean, it is about celebrating, of course, the achievements of disabled people in the past, but it's also about remembering, I guess, realizing how prevalent disability is in not only the lives of many people today, but also a lot of inventors and creators and leaders and people in the past.
Yeah, that's like a an ongoing discussion. I work a lot in music reporting, specifically with artists with disabilities, and it's always
Right.
a balance between, we want to give space for artists with disabilities, but we don't necessarily want to tokenize their space as musicians in virtue of their
Yeah.
disabilities. So
Yeah, exactly.
it's a really difficult balance.
Yeah, you want to give attention, you want to give like focus and celebration, but you don't want to like, I guess, objectivize or make people like a spectacle kind of thing. Yeah, I can easily unwind into that really quickly.
So, next question. Feel free to answer in as little or as much detail as you feel comfortable with. What is
Sure.
your personal relationship with accessibility?
Yeah, so I mean, I identify as neurodivergent, so my brain, I just it doesn't function the way I found other people's brains or neurotypical brains tend to function. And so that's kind of been an ongoing process for me for understanding myself. And so in academia, it's been interesting because my brain functions in a way where I can excel academically. So like working for long periods of focus, special interests, and so in that way, I was less aware of, I guess, my own embodiment because it just seemed like I was really good at academic work. But then as I got older and realized, oh, actually, there's something else here. So that's kind of my personal relationship with accessibility.
So, did you, what did, does your personal relationship or did your personal relationship with accessibility and being neurodivergent affect your field of study by in any ways? Like, is that a reason why you chose to study embodiment and disability, or is there
This
like
is No, this is a really good question. No, actually, it was actually the opposite. So it was actually me being unaware of my own personal experience, and then studying, and then taking a closer look at myself. So actually, studying disability in the past and embodiment in the past actually helped me become more familiar with my own embodiment today, which
That's
I
really
thought was,
cool.
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the kind of history that I really love because I realized it wasn't just about kind of going into the past and getting lost there, but it was really actually about bringing the past into the present and like thinking ethically about myself. So, yeah.
That's a really interesting kind of chain of events. I feel like it's normally people go into a field of study because of something in their personal life that they feel very drawn to or inspired by. So it's funny that you were like, oh, this embodiment thing, and they were like, wait a second.
Well, and that is usually the case. People think, oh, like, do you study disability? because, you know, you live with disability. And I guess when I started, I was trying to demonstrate for other people that you don't have to necessarily have personal experience with a disability to warrant like diving into these fields, right? Like, of course, it's essential for people with disabilities to be studying these things, and we want to make sure that they're included and they're leading the charge. But at the same time, it's not just kind of this niche thing for only the people who identify, because I think it can be enriching for neurotypical people, for able-bodied people. It's enriching for so many other people. So that's kind of why I entered the field in the first place.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I found online that you wrote a book.
Yes.
A disabled hostel. And yeah. I presume, was that the topic of your PhD thesis?
Yeah, it was the topic of my PhD thesis, yeah.
A lot of work to do a thesis and write a book, so.
Yes, yeah. I mean, thankfully, a lot of the thesis stuff gets used in the book, so yeah, it was, yeah. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what drew you to this topic, and what it's a little, and tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, so the book is really about, so we talked about this guy, Paul, who's kind of a key figure in early Christianity. He's kind of a missionary, one of the first ones that kind of goes around. And his letters are very influential for religious communities even today. The book thinks about him from a disability perspective. There's been a lot of speculation based on his letters that he might have had a disability, but people haven't really been sure what it was. And so I kind of approached looking at him using critical disability studies today, so kind of our advances in philosophy and sociology and history, thinking about disability. And part of the book is about, when we think about disability today, it's often kind of like medicalized taxonomies, right? Like the DSM, or kind of biomedical science, like, you know, you have this condition, or you've broken these bones, or, you know, you have this level of T cells or whatever. But it's not only, that's only kind of like one kind of medicalized perspective on disability. So my book thinks about disability as relative to particular cultures and bodily ideals, that you might be visually impaired. So the visual impairments are the same in the past and the present today, but there might not be stigma, or there might not be kind of social exclusion or inaccessibility. It really just depends on a particular condition. So the book, at the heart of the book, it's really just about how do we think about disability in the past, and maybe what are some kind of bodily conditions that we don't consider disabilities today that might have been considered disabilities in the past.
Can you give an example of one?
Yeah, so I mean, a controversial example is for Paul is so spirit possession. So he lives in a world where there are kind of not non-physical, but invisible forces that like infiltrate people's bodies, right? This term, like demons. And, you know, in a post-Enlightenment, very rationalist world today, for a lot of people, that's just not the case. But in the time that Paul lives, this is kind of an everyday reality. So in one of his letters, he does talk about having some kind of spiritual force in or affecting his body. So I talk about that in a wider kind of Mediterranean context and what spirit possession looks like, and the kind of stigma towards it, and the fear of having your body kind of invaded by this external force. I mean, the fear is still there today. We see ton like possession movies or exorcism movies, and that always play on this idea of the loss of human autonomy. So that's kind of one example that I explore.
Okay.
Yeah. Not that I necessarily believe that such spiritual forces exist, but in ancient history, that's what these people believe.
So in this like context, and obviously like in ye olden days, they didn't have the word disability, or quite the conceptualization that we did. And disability is, well, it's largely a social concept.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what my understanding is. It was like whatever we as a society deemed was quote unquote abnormal or not able-bodied is considered to be disability. So having said spiritual possessions would be considered a disability in its own right, is that a controversial
in the past it's not controversial, but to say it today, it is controversial. And there are still religious communities, for example, there are still religious communities that think like if you have depression, then you are, might be like oppressed by some spiritual force. And I think it does have real consequences. In the epilogue to my book, I talk about some really violent examples where this kind of rhetoric continues to affect people today. And so I guess one of the implications of the book is to interrogate those assumptions that they can lead to really dangerous ideas, and they can actually affect not only people's quality of life, but it can like affect people's safety. So it really is about critiquing what kinds of bodily ideals people hold up and the kinds of values they attach to them.
Interesting. I think it's really interesting that you don't outright say that you study disability, rather you study embodiment. I think that to say disability brings you or offers a lot of bias in terms of what we think of. Like when I think of disability, it's a very modern definition versus embodiment. Mm-hmm. I have a much cleaner slate. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what exactly that refers to. And it is in a way referring to a kind of disability, but a different cultural norm.
That's exactly it.
Wow, I am so smart.
I mean, it's you are very smart. There's no doubt about that. It's also because I think it's also, I like embodiment because things like disability or sexuality or gender or ethnicity, these things, they can't really be separated from one another. Like if we've learned anything from, you know, intersectionality, these things bleed over into one another and they affect one another. So embodiment is really it's kind of focusing on the lived experience of humans who have a physical form and who navigate in the world. And sometimes when it's hitting social and cultural stigma, that's a mode of disability. Sometimes when it's talking about, performativity and expectations about gender, you know, then we're talking about, you know, gender and things like that. So I think it's a kind of nexus point where you can shift into multiple conversations without necessarily abandoning all the other kind of facets.
Yeah, I see it as like a real kind of intersection of a lot of different things and not just disability.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really cool. I've never quite thought about it that way. I've always thought of intersectionality, as a bunch of different roads and never just like one neighborhood.
I love the neighborhood community facet. I think it is, it's like one neighborhood, one community, but then like, you know, you have different facets of humanness which are being emphasized. Because people's experiences are different. So yeah, I've never viewed them as separate roads, but often kind of somehow, maybe in some kind of quantum universe, roads that are parallel to one another, but headed in different directions or things like that.
Metaphysics.
Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, I just don't want to think about metaphysics ever
again. Yeah, that's right. Well, you're just about to graduate. So, you don't need to think about anything. Right? You've done your thinking.
So I have another question. And it's, so you studied a lot of early history of figures who you argue had disabilities.
Yeah.
You see kind of early seeds of how disability was treated or considered that you can compare to today's conception of disability.
Yeah. Sorry, what was the question?
no worries. So I think disability is or the concept of disability is really a living thing. It's always changing and evolving, and people are arguing about the discourse of language and what it means to be disabled. So you've really studied a lot of early literature and early figures who may or may not have had disabilities or embody that space. Do you see similarities in early disability and today?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So, I mean, I think there are some similarities of like particular types of conditions, like if it's visual impairment or mobility impairments. Often like visual disabilities are this often kind of consistency between the past and today. Where I see kind of like the greatest overlap are in the kind of reinforcement of bodily ideals. So at the heart of like disability is like this desire, not the desire, but cultural kind of inertia towards making bodies conform to this kind of normal or bodily ideal, right? You got two hands, you've got two feet, you can walk, you can see, you can hear, this kind of ideal body. And so where I see like the biggest overlap is this kind of a lot of pressure that's bound up with religious discourses like Christianity, which is like always pushing bodies towards back to that norm, and conforming bodies to that kind of thing. And we see a lot of cultural pressure today. I mean, most things about our world are very, very inaccessible still, despite like the important activism of disability rights advocates for the last 50 years. So, but there's still, I mean, we saw this during COVID, the reluctance to move kind of to online spaces, or even to make spaces accessible by wearing masks or getting vaccinated or things like that. And yeah, so that's kind of the biggest overlap I see from the past, is this constant push towards, well, your body should be like this. And of course we live in an even wilder age with social media, where you can physically change, or you can put on filters that change your body to conform to a particular ideal. And of course, this is something that's exacerbates, you know, particularly affects women as well. Just the constant pressure for your bodies to behave and appear and look like this kind of ideal, impossible youth or something like that. And so that I see that overlap from the past to the present.
Have you studied any cultures that really deviate from this norm? Or is it just
a thing? There's every culture has some kind of bodily norm. So while the ideals differ from culture to culture, there's always kind of a pressure to conform. I would say the only culture that I'm familiar with, I mean, those who track in disability circles, I think the beauty of disability communities is just the kind of plurality of ideals, that there's not kind of one overarching way of being human and living. And so there's a really huge celebration of different abilities and forms and figures and appearance. And that is very much like out of history, because most cultures prioritize some kinds of ideals, whereas in disabled communities, you see a rejection of that kind of body politic, body power kind of thing.
Interesting. So I, throughout my degree, really did not see a ton of courses specifically about disability. I took like a social and political philosophy course where we talked about how disability is seen throughout the world and treated throughout the world. I've seen course codes about music and disability specifically, and I tried to take it, but it was canceled. So I was sad about that. But have you seen a lot of disability-related discourse in the field of academia?
I mean, there's a lot of disability discourse in like published research, and it's a growing amount. But as far as like people who are familiar with disability studies, it is still really rare. Like I had to go out of my way during my own graduate work to kind of work in this field. And even though it's been going on for, in my field, 20 or 30 years, it's still, the trickle down is very, very slow. And unfortunately, you know, in places, I mean, with whatever is going on in the US, there's a lot of programs at colleges, disability studies programs that are closing down. So programs that are available are becoming less available, and the people who are teaching them are kind of out of work because of just kind of whatever social stuff is going on. So I haven't seen that much. I mean, I teach a course on disability in the Bible here at UBC, and I think it's one of the first courses in Canada that focuses on that. There are some other scholars who work here. So I know Jay Logan Smilges in English. They do great work, like fantastic work on disability. And probably will be running more courses, but it's still very niche.
Do you think that disability studies could one day become a field as, and I think this question is really prefaced by, well, I'm like going on my own train of thought.
Let's go there.
The gears are turning in my head because when I think of disability studies, I think it's like a very unseen fabric in our world. It's a very unrecognized fabric in our world. I think it's very similar to feminist thought, Black thought, a lot of really crucial ways of knowing about the world that are authoritative in virtue of having lived experiences. And I think those, like, for example, a lot of Black feminist thought have really made a space in a lot of philosophy. And it's become very integrated into the field at UBC. Do you think that disability studies could one day become a thread of fabric in academic studies that is also as heavily considered?
I mean, I do think so. I would really hope so. I want it to, because I think it's, I mean, I, not just socially, because I think it's important for justice reasons, but I think also just education-wise, like it is, I love what you just said right there about how it just really influences authoritative ways of thinking and knowing. And I think it is an essential facet that people often kind of overlook. Like if they don't realize they have a disability or know someone who lives with disabilities, it's just kind of not on their radar. But the second that you start studying it and thinking it, you actually realize, oh, actually, this stuff is happening all around me. You're living in it. And eventually your body is going to be affected by it, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, disabilities. We're all going to be disabled at some point in our life.
Yeah, it's just, what's the, some people say temporarily abled.
Yeah.
And so I would hope so, because I think it, because it can be jarring for a lot of people, don't realize how much their identity is wrapped in what they can physically do.
Yeah.
And their own abilities. And I think dealing with the fact that the world is really not set up to accommodate or make their lives accessible, dealing with that earlier can help other people who need the accessibility now, but then also prepare for later when accessibility is something that they're going to need themselves.
That was a very well-worded answer to my very convoluted question. So you are a, you've recently started your position at UBC as a,
yes,
I understand.
Yeah.
So accessibility in post-secondary education is a very hot topic at UBC. And there are varying levels of authority on it. Like there's the central, there's the Center for Accessibility, but other professors have their own policies on accessibility for students. Given your experience with accessibility and what you study, what are your thoughts on accessibility in post-secondary schools?
Yeah, I mean, I can comment on maybe not just UBC, but other institutions I've been at, like at Oxford and Durham in the UK. I mean, I appreciate, I'm a big fan of what the CFA do and how they advocate for students. And I always think there can be more. More that can be done. And I think for me, the perspective that I see some oftentimes is kind of from a faculty perspective, and I've only been here for a year. And I'm not throwing any one particular person under the bus here, but sometimes I think from faculty in various positions I talk to, the two things I think that can change, one thing that can really change is I find some faculty just don't believe students. If they have accessibility needs. And I find that really, really troubling. I don't require students to, so if students need like an extension for me or they need something, I don't require any explanation. Like I tell students at the beginning, you know your own bodies better than me. If you need something, just let me know and I'm gonna try and accommodate. Of course there are boundaries, like I can't like accommodate you till like way after graduation. I'm trying to the best I can. But I always believe students. Even if I feel like they might be lying to me, I'm not suspicious of students. So I worry sometimes when I, if I hear a faculty member who is just who kind of questions whether a student is actually disabled. Sometimes you hear people saying things like, you know, people just use it as an excuse to get out of things. And I don't find that kind of language really, really helpful at all. Other things about accessibility in academia and post-secondary education as well. I mean, post-secondary education is just an extremely ableist machine. There's very little about it that does not privilege ability, right? Like exams privilege memorization, they privilege memory, they privilege the ability to think on the spot. Classes privilege communication, the people who are outgoing, who don't feel social anxiety, or who are just trying to contain their tics or stim quietly and not, you know, blurt out whatever or ask questions or things like that. In ancient history, like field work, I love this like go global stuff. Like, is it really accessible? Like, do we make it accessible for folks who have mobility impairments or other kinds of things? I think there can always be improvement there. And I think that improvement only comes when people are really not only listening and trusting disabled experiences, but really spending time in disabled communities and actually seeing how inaccessible the systems get. And not just kind of, you know, this is kind of the bare minimum we need to do, or this is kind of what's legislated, or kind of the suggestions from the biomedical community. Yeah, so that's kind of my long rant. I think we've made great advances in accessibility. I think there's a lot more improvements that needs to be done. From my perspective, I think there's a lot more work that can be done on the faculty level. And I know everyone's, you know, trying to get better, but I think we still have a long road to go.
Yeah, I have two thoughts that I came up with when hearing that. One of which is, yeah, I had a professor last term, and their policy was, if you need an extension, just ask. I'll give you an automatic 5 days. If you need more, we can discuss and try to work something out. And they were like, I also don't want you to tell me why. Like, I actually don't want you to give me your medical information or kind of have to do this performative show of struggle in order to get a 5-day extension on an assignment. Like, that just doesn't feel necessary. Mm-hmm. And that was like the first time a professor has ever explicitly been like, don't tell me. Like, they were like, it's your business.
Yeah.
I also don't want to hear about your breakup with your partner. Like, stuff happens.
Yeah, stuff happens. I tell my students, like, when we're at the beginning of term, I always say, you know, you think you're going to meet the deadlines now, but I'm like, when it's like week 10 and your personal life is on fire, like,
yeah,
it's going to happen. But yeah, I appreciate that. I'm glad to hear that someone else is out there doing
really,
that.
Really great instructor. Cared so much about students' well-being. And secondly, I also thought about what you said about, what was I thinking about? This is like the magic of post-editing as well. Shout out.
Yeah, for sure.
Shout out post-production. I was thinking about what you said on how academia is a very able-bodied space. And I think that it's really crazy to me that universities expect you to go through 4 or 5 years of a degree and have no major personal disasters happen.
Yeah.
And be extremely difficult when you need accommodation.
Yeah.
And this is like beyond what you said about, or this is sort of along the lines of what you said about, we will all be disabled at some point in our life. Like, there will be points in our life where we will be unable to work or do school for whatever reason. Yeah. And every single person I know who has had a personal emergency, myself included, has had UBC and some professors like really like make it hard.
Right.
Just be like, I need like 3 weeks off, or I need to like take this term off and come back next term. And I've had some professors that have been incredibly gracious and sympathetic. But I've had others that are that make it a personal grievance for them.
Yeah.
I think that's really just grounded in a lack of empathy. And that's where I think what you said about living and being in disabled communities is really important. I feel like empathy really comes from being able to truly understand in virtue of being put in that space.
Yeah.
But then that there's also this like weird dichotomy of like, to understand, you need to be in that space, you need to have an understanding of that lived experience, but also it's a very vulnerable place to put these people, or like the marginalized group, in, to have all these like outsiders looking into their lived experience. Mm. So it's a really tricky thing to do.
I mean, to your point, I mean, firstly, I'm sorry that, I mean, that's your experience.
I think it's every student at UBC at some point. Yeah.
I guess when I say like getting in disabled communities, I don't mean like as like kind of being scientists, like observing kind of thing. Yeah. But I think like just real, I mean, I think in reality, most people are already embedded in communities with people with disabilities. They just don't know it or aren't aware of it or attuned to it. And so I do agree that there has to be like a level of compassion. And with a big university, I mean, UBC is like, it's huge. And so I'm not giving excuses for the institution, but because it's so big, there's like a inertia towards keeping some kind of order for the sake of what they would term equity. But at the same time, it creates a lot of inequitable circumstances. And as a student, I can understand the fear, like when you go into a classroom, it's rolling the dice. You don't know if a professor is going to be, they could be like a really personable professor, but they might not be really empathetic, and you're just not really sure. And I think that does sometimes affect students. Like sometimes I feel like students take my courses, not because they're necessarily interested in my courses, like totally interested, but they just know that it's going to be like a safe place where if something does go wrong, I'm not going to like try and steamroll them. And I, on the one hand, I'm happy to have students in my class, not complaining. But on the other hand, I hope to work towards an institution more widely where accessibility is taken really, really serious. And it does mean it's more like more inconvenient for administration and faculty and things like that. But I think if we can shoulder the inconvenience together rather than just distributing it all onto the individual, I think that's a price that I'm willing to pay.
I agree. I really agree with that. And to speak to what you said about students gravitating towards classes where professors may be more personable or empathetic, like I've done that. I like towards the end of my degree, I like really picked classes where I was like, I really, one, enjoy this professor's teaching style. I really absorb information with the way they teach. And also like, I feel like they're a professor who I can come to ask for help.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of relationship that you have with a teacher is really what made my degree. I feel like the lessons that I took away most from university were about how to speak to authoritative figures and kind of like learn how to learn and ask for help. Through picking the right professors.
And I think that's the most optimal learning environment. Like sometimes people go into a classroom and like they're there to like show that they're good at what they do.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'm like there to like, I come out of like a vocational sector. So I'm there to like help people gain the skills that I have, and we're like working together towards that end. And I think, yeah, I mean, that makes for me, even in the past, that makes for my favorite kind of classes too, where I don't feel like I'm being taught at, but I feel like I'm being taught.
Engaging. Yeah. When I think of the classes that I've taken that were like, you show me how good you are at something, it's all like symbolic logic proofs. And I'm like, oh, I'm just doing math with words. But I think I also was very lucky to be in philosophy where it was all very discussion based. And we really got to flex those like thinking skills a lot. And sometimes you were stepped on for having bad ideas, but at least people had justifications as to why they were bad.
Sure, sure. I mean, confrontation is just a part of growing up, right? You're dealing with.
Yeah, it's a part of academia debate I learned.
Yeah.
But
People don't always play on the same, like, fair. I don't think they always play fair. Yeah, it's definitely.
so you're going into your second year as a
Yes.
professor. What are you working on right now? Are you allowed to say?
Would I not be allowed to say? Am I sworn to secrecy?
I don't know.
I mean, I've just sent off 2 books. So this
Wow.
summer, we're working on courses for next year. So
That's really exciting.
yeah.
Are
So
you going to be
I'm,
staying in the Amity field?
yep.
Are you going
Yeah.
to teach
So
your course again? Disability
on
related?
disability?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe in like 2 years' time.
Yeah.
Depends on what the cycle might be. Yeah, but hopefully again. I'm hoping I'm pitching something like disability in the ancient Mediterranean or ancient world or something at like a
Okay.
200 level or 300 level course, but I
Yeah.
don't know.
Interesting. That's really
Yeah.
great to hear. I
Yeah.
really
Yeah.
hope that you are given opportunities to teach more classes about disability, contextualized
Yeah.
embodiment, because that's a
Yeah, me
really
too.
unique and cool concept.
Thank you.
That could be in so many different schools of thought.
I know it's, I mean, it is really widely, it's widely applicable. So,
Yeah. Thank you so much.
yeah, no, thanks for having me today, Nicole.
Are you a writer?
Listener?
Dreamer?
Music nerd?
Want to cover artists?
Visit venues?
Write something?
Events?
Personal essays?
Anything?
Submit to Discorder magazine and then take it a step further on Hail Discordia with your hosts, Zoe
And Izzy. Hail Discordia is an audio translation of Discorder magazine. We interview writers, play music and soundscapes, and do a deep dive of each zine issue. Hail Discordia plays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the third Thursday of every month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Submit something for the magazine and come onto the show, or just tune in and listen. We promise it's worth it.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyber web? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void. Loneliness, loneliness.